Hi, I'm Ray DeBicke, and this is the Urbanist Podcast, where we discuss news, information, and ideas about improving cities and quality of life.
And I'm Natalie Argarius. It's graduation week for Seattle Public Schools, so we're going to talk about the school year. Stick around. All right, Ray, so I think you were the one who had the initial idea to talk about the end of the school year, and that's because you not only have two children who are enrolled in Seattle Public Schools, or SPS. Do people usually say SPS?
We call them other names too, but yeah, SPS.
Okay. And not only that, you're involved with the PTA, so you have an insider perspective on what's been going down.
It's fun because it is the end of the school year, so we get to do all of the cool things. I think last week I mentioned we had a carnival. We did get it in before and after all of the rain, and I think everybody had a pretty good time. But yeah, it is. We have an elementary schooler who is finishing up their time as a fifth grader, and we have a seventh grader who next year gets to start thinking about high schools.
So where are things at, you know, sitting here at the end of the school year, looking back at the school year?
I have to start with February. In February, we started running into schools having to do testing because, people were coming down with Omicron. Classes would be cut a little short. We had to go in a couple times to do compulsory testing, a bunch of different things like that. And what it occurred to me is that this is the fourth consecutive interrupted year. And that sounds a little weird because we've only been in coronavirus for two. This year, schools were open the entire year. Last year, we had the entire first half of the year remote, and then kids only went back, some of them only went back at the end of the year for a couple hours a day. The year before that was, of course, 2019-2020, when the curtain fell come March and everything went haywire. And then before that, in 2018-2019, we missed almost the entire month of February due to snow.
That's right. You know, I forgot about the weather disruption that had occurred. And have there been problems as well with SPS staffing along the way?
We've had a couple of years where either a couple of days at the beginning or a couple of days at the end have run into strikes as the teachers have fought for smaller class sizes or more accommodations for special education, smaller dockets for school counselors.
And I seem to remember this year, people I know who have children who are enrolled in SPS telling me that they had days in which their schools were simply closed because there weren't enough staff.
Was it the day after Veterans Day? It was essentially school was closed on a Thursday, and so many teachers called out on Friday that there just wasn't enough subs to cover it. And because we were dealing with pandemic restrictions of you couldn't put the whole school into the cafeteria and have them watch a movie, they closed schools.
Wow. That just created a really strong visual for me as you said that. So it's funny because from an outsider's perspective, somebody who does not have children and who's not really familiar with the Seattle public school system, I thought this was more of a normal year.
It kept trying to be. I think that's the upshot, is that everybody talks about the new normal. And this was just a whole lot of attempts to be as normal as possible.
Okay. Well, we're going to have you do your parent report card, which I'm really excited about. And before we segue into that, I just want to share that I do have a background in education. I taught middle school in the past. I have taught community college for many years, including a large number of high school students. So I will be taking a bit of a teacher's perspective as you do your rundown.
Well, I think to start is we do have to say, at the top, teaching was good. I mean, across the board, this is a very, very difficult time. So if what I saw was that whatever teachers could get their hands on a kid and actually talk to them, the teachers did great. They get an A+, because this is hard. This is really, really difficult. And every teacher I saw was trying as hard as they could and knocking it out of the park where they did.
That's really interesting. And so when you say knocking it out of the park, was there a lot of hands-on learning? Was there hybrid learning going on some of these days where there was limited staffing? Or what did this look like?
So last year in 2020-21, the first half of the year was all remote. And so the teachers were doing whatever they could to keep the kids engaged. At the end of the year, there was a couple of weeks, about 10 weeks at the end of the year, where the governor told everybody, you got to get back to school. And so schools reopened. And what we saw there was teachers doing whatever kind of hybrid they could, because a bunch of kids couldn't get back into school. And so the kids that were in the classroom had a little bit of hands-on time with the teacher, and then the teacher broadcast to both in the classroom and online.
And, you know, coming from the perspective of somebody who spent a lot of time in classroom instruction, I can imagine that would be incredibly difficult. And also, we have to recognize that many of these teachers were learning on the go. I was fortunate because prior to the pandemic, I completed a year-long certificate in instructional design for e-learning. And as a result, I was able to pivot to synchronous, which means at the same time, if you're not used to education speak, synchronous online classes. So where my students were, you know, tuning in at the same time, and I was providing them with online activities to complete together. If I hadn't had the training, if I hadn't been knowledgeable about the tools and the best practices, it would have been really tough. So I imagine for a lot of these teachers, they were just moving into uncharted territory.
I think a lot of parents saw that because what we saw from the parent side was just a encyclopedia list of weird names. There was doodles and booklet bookets and this and that and all these different online apps that teachers were just kind of trying to throw at the wall and see what worked, because they could use some of these in the classroom and the kids loved them, but did it work when the kid was sitting at home?
That is such a good question. And it's true that there's a lot of ed tech that's out there, but actually implementing it with your particular group of students, their age, their emotional level, their interests, whether or not you're teaching in a face-to-face or an online modality, can really change the effectiveness of these tools.
I think when you mentioned education terminology, I think a lot of parents have kind of get themselves wrapped up because, oh my gosh, this is new math. Oh my gosh, this is what? I don't know all of these words. And one thing I've learned over in listening to the kids learn is the social-emotional learning, SEL. And the emphasis that the teachers have put on social-emotional learning this year, I think that is really what's put teaching over the top in this post-pandemic situation.
Could you talk to me a little bit about what that looks like in practice?
For what I've seen with social-emotional learning with the kids, they are getting steeped in all of the emotional words that we never grew up with. Things along the lines like, instead of just saying, I'm angry, it is, are you feeling bad and high energy? Are you feeling bad and low energy? It's really kind of pulling apart some of these emotions. And they have posters that have different names for, are you angry or are you anxious? Are you angry or are you, and really kind of naming some of these things. Coming as a parent who has watched the kids struggle over the last year and a half, the emphasis on social emotional learning this year with the kids in the classroom has been top notch and vital.
And it appears that the teachers seemed like they were invested in this and prepared to do this. Because I can just say in my own experience, which has mostly been as a community college faculty member, there have been times where I haven't felt prepared to help my students socially and emotionally, but maybe there was a larger support system that was being put out by the schools.
Yes, there has been a lot of support. I can say from our schools, like every teacher has a badge on the back of their ID that is a chart that has that kind of high energy, low energy, good mood, bad mood, that if the kid's fighting for words, the teacher kind of holds up the chart, their badge, and says, "Where you at?" And the kids have a lot more emotional learning time, a lot more sitting in circles. Somebody's not paying attention, it sounds a little kumbaya, but these kids have been through a earth-shattering event and they need it.
Okay, so they definitely need it, and I'm glad that they were receiving this very important social, emotional learning. But what about the actual academics, the reading, writing, arithmetic?
From everything that I've seen, I would give the academics portion of it like a B, maybe a low B, but it's the kids are playing catch up. And what we know is that their success going forward is going to be completely dependent on the neighborhood they're growing up in. I mean, kids who are in wealthier neighborhoods, and we've seen the maps of Seattle, there are all of the elementary schools south of 90, south of Interstate 90, are all Title I schools in poor districts who receive extra federal support. North of that, it's different. There are fewer schools that need that support. And the schools in the north, where we live, are going to do okay. The kids are going to do academically well. I just don't know that we have fully wrapped our heads around what well is going to be.
That's what I want to know. It's like, from a parent's perspective, do you feel like your kids are at grade level based on everything that happened over the past 2 years?
In math, no. In reading and writing, yes. I have seen and talked to other parents who that is flipped because their kids did a whole lot better kind of away from other kids doing math, but needed more hands-on teacher support in order to get the reading done, get the creative juices flowing for writing. So it is really a split decision, and I don't think we know what it's going to look like at the end.
I totally agree with you on that. And I think, you know, some of the discrepancies that we would see that were related to educational attainment in the household and income were really magnified during this pandemic. And I think of the case of my nephew, who's 10 years old and lives in Florida. He had a grandmother who was a elementary school teacher, retired, who became his private tutor for the entire pandemic. And he had gone from, you know, doing fairly well in school, slightly struggling with certain subjects, to being at the top of the class because of the personalized attention he received.
It's kind of nice to have that leg up every once in a while, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's something where, you know, had the pandemic not occurred, I don't know that she would have spent as much one-to-one time with this, but she actually created like a classroom for him. And because both his parents were working, he would go to her house every day and spend that time with her. And he was getting just a whole lot of support. And I know there was other kids who their parents were working, taking care of other children, had lots of responsibilities. And the best they could do is like, okay, is the computer working? Did you log in? So coming back from that, I'm sure that teachers are dealing with a scenario that maybe is most well known by kindergarten teachers, where when a kindergarten teacher enters the classroom at the beginning of the year, they really do not know what to expect from their students. Mm-hmm. And there's a enormous variety in terms of preparation. I have to think that almost any teacher in the particularly like K-9 system right now was feeling like that going into this year.
I can say that the elementary schooler going through remote learning could not find any more ways to misuse her chair while staring at the computer because it was just so dissonant. She was just so ready to not be doing this.
Yeah. So one of the things that when I, so I did do a master's degree in curriculum and instruction and studied educational psychology as part of that. And one of the things that they show really contributes to learning and also retention of learning material is how many different parts of your brain you're engaging at the same time. And that's why for many people, simply just like watching and listening to something on a screen is not going to result in the same deep level of learning because you don't have that bodily experience. And when you're in the classroom, even if you're still there watching and listening, you're physically present and you have the awareness of another physically present person who's teaching you, and you have the opportunity to move around and engage and mimic each other's gestures. And there's all sorts of things that the brain will do that it's not going to do online. And so you have to be very intentional as an online educator about finding ways to engage.
One of the transitions that happened early in the year for the elementary schooler, I got a message from her teacher that said, look, she's passing notes in class.
I think I did that maybe a few times.
And I said, and this was this early this year, and they're just back in after all of this remote learning. And I said, did you read the note? What did the note say? And the teacher, bless her, said she was organizing getting her group together for the next event. And I said, we understand that they just spent a year and a half with a chat function. And then the teacher said, yes, we completely understand that, but we just kind of got to ramp out of some of this. And so when you start talking about engaging all of the brain in many different ways, it was interesting during remote learning to see the chat function pop up as sort of the social bit and making sure that they're not completely alone.
I'm glad to hear that. It's true that humanity seems to find a way to make itself like present even in these new tech environments. And I'm glad to hear that kids were still finding a way to connect. Let's talk about the administration. So you've talked about teachers, and as somebody who's, you know, been an educator for a long time, I have lots of, you know, experiences related to administration. So I'd love to hear what you think of how they did in the last year.
So I always have to break down the administration into the stuff at the school and the stuff at headquarters. And I don't have a ton of good things to say about the stuff at headquarters. I mean, we're talking maybe a C-level effort in so much of Seattle Public Schools' headquarters work, because we kept getting messages that very much showed they're kind of not thinking ahead. They're being very reactive. I've tried to do some after-school stuff at school, and they just said, look, we're not reconsidering our rules on after-school until summer next year. When we did have a compulsory testing day, COVID testing day, it was not run nearly as efficiently as our school nurse doing it herself. And that stunk. But at school administration, our principal, our vice principal, we got a ton of information from them. And unfortunately, too many times they had to say, that's all the info I have, and that's the pipeline coming from headquarters.
Okay. So you talked about not being able to schedule these after-school activities. So something, you know, as somebody who does not have children, that I think about a lot is what happens when the school day ends, because it ends earlier than most people stop working. So there was no after-school care, no after-school activities provided by the public system?
Nope. And there were some after-school care facilities, like the Boys and Girls Club here is still open. I believe they were restarting the on-campus after-school care, but they were facing the exact same hiring problem that so many other folks are. I mean, we know that it's impossible to find daycare and it's impossible to find after-school care, and that's run into problems. But the normal before and after school kind of enrichment stuff, nothing.
Okay. So another point that I've already read and heard was a weak point for the school year was transportation. I'd love to hear your experience with that and, yeah, busing.
I if you had asked me before Christmas, it would have been a solid F.
Okay.
I mean, we are just outside of the walk zone for the middle school. And so technically there's supposed to be a bus that came by. And for, I don't know, 8 weeks at the beginning of school, I would get a message every day that said, your bus is going to be an hour late before and an hour late after school. And that doesn't make a lick of sense, because it's once you're an hour late for school, what are you even talking about here? The way we overcame it was I got her riding the bus, the public bus, because the network of buses right where I am will drop them off at the middle school very close. And what we saw was a lot of kids getting themselves used to riding public transit.
Well, that is maybe the best outcome that could come out of it, especially for kids who are older. But I'm just looking at the district's webpage right now related to busing. And this was, of course, a bit earlier this spring, but they were saying that they were trying to restore bus routes as soon as possible. And that, you know, they're trying to serve transportation dependent students. But I have to think that all these students are transportation dependent.
We don't really build the city in order to move kids around. We built the city in order to get as many, you know, adults heading downtown to their offices as possible. And we kind of overlook the fact that it would be really nice for kids to hop on and off the bus, the public bus, fairly straightforward.
Okay. And so then when I read also transportation dependent here, are they meaning, I guess, schools were either one, there aren't a lot of kids that walk, or two, aren't a lot of parents that can drive? Because I think a lot of kids get driven, right?
There's a lot of overlap in the two. And when they draw these walk circles for the schools, when they encounter a hard barrier, Market Street and Ballard, they don't draw across Market Street because Market Street's too big. And the school boundary ends at 15th. So that's just a highway. And the walking comes from unsafe the lack of walking comes from a lot of unsafe conditions.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I can imagine, you know, maybe a middle schooler crossing Market Street, but definitely not a 6-year-old.
Oh my gosh, right? And so the transportation has kind of gotten better, but we ran into a problem in the spring, where the Seattle Public Schools is now re-upping the contract with First Student. And that has a lot of controversy along with it too, because First Student has been the source of a lot of these busing issues.
Yes. I think actually The Stranger had a post on this that was titled Seattle Public Schools Bus Drama Explodes Again.
It's amazing that the other options for buses got just lopped off the table.
Wow. I'm reading here quickly that it said that First Student's charter bus service was found to have committed more than 600 safety and procedure violations.
They have they've not been able to track students in a way that a lot of parents would hope the bus drivers could. They've not been able to show up and drop kids off at the correct places. It's a litany and it's concerning.
So is there any sense of what the replacement will be next year? I see here that there's a company referred to as Zoom that may potentially be filling in.
I think what's going to end up happening is they're going to reopen the bid, have everybody submit, and then we're going to end up with First Student anyway.
Okay. We'll see.
That's my betting line.
Okay, so then how, you know, while this was going on and while these bus routes were getting suspended or put on hold, how did the school communicate that to you?
The communication from Seattle Public Schools is wonky. Every piece of information comes four different ways. Except for the piece of information that you need right at that moment when it kind of just disappears. So I will get a phone call. I think I'll probably get a phone call at some point today that will say this is a reminder, Friday is the last day of school, and it will be an hour early dismissal. And that will come via email, that will come through a secondary email, that will come over the phone, and that information kind of marches out regularly. Unfortunately, things along the lines of there's a whole gap in communication for other stuff. We had an experience this year with the middle school where just the day after the massacre in Uvalde, Texas, where 19 kids were killed, I got a message from the middle schooler saying, hey, do you know why we're on lockdown?
Yikes. And that was a text message, right?
That was a text message from the kiddo. And I went into straight like mega parent mode and was like, where is information about this? And it ends up that there was a fight at the school and an ambulance was called and they went into a modified stick in your room thing. But they didn't tell the kids about what was going on. They didn't come over the PA and say, there's a situation. Everybody just needs to stay in their room. Everything's fine. And so the kids all have phones is texting out. And so the school system didn't take the second step to explain what happened. Only through showing up at a meeting a little later did we find out, oh, it was this. Here's what's going on.
I can just imagine for children in that situation, knowing what had happened so recently in the tragedy in Uvalde, that it would be really scary.
I think this goes back to the social emotional learning thing. They have the capacity to talk about this a lot better than we ever did. But yeah, they're terrified.
So talking about safety, I just want to briefly touch on the fact that the Senate had passed a suite of legislation around gun safety that seems to be pretty narrowly focused on preventing shootings in schools. And part of that is going to mean beefing up security in schools. What does security look like in the schools that your kids are attending today?
The schools only have one door for visitors to go in and out, and you got to get buzzed in.
Okay.
And so the campuses themselves might be big and open and things like that, but it's not a fortress. If a nefarious actor wanted to be nefarious, they could, but it's a school and parents are going in and out in order to get their kids for doctor's appointments. And you can't have a complete bunker and still expect children to be picked up in a reasonable amount of time at the end of the day.
No, and they don't have any of that like high-tech AI facial recognition they were testing out at some private schools in the area.
What ridiculousness. I mean, come on. You really want to upload your kid's face into the web now? Come on. Ridiculous.
All right, so where do we go from here?
I think the hardest part of this school year has been the attempt to put a normal facade on what is a deeply abnormal time. And the teachers have been doing a super job of saying, look, we know everything's weird. We're just exhausted. And they deserve every bit of support that they can get. In the near term for Seattle Public Schools, it's a teacher contract year. We've already gotten messages that say, hey, SPS is doing their darndest to cooperate with teachers' unions. I don't put a strong faith in SPS's communication because it was a year ago that they sent out a blast text message to just badmouth the teachers' union.
Well, I think it's going to be definitely really contentious negotiations because you have inflation, and typically teachers' contracts are adjusted based on cost of living, and the increase in cost of living has been really substantial. And I wonder if the state in its budget currently has enough funding delegated to cover, what would be seen as a reasonable COLA for this time. The other thing I have a question about too is the fact that there is a shrinking enrollment, and we can talk about that in a little bit, but how that might affect how many positions are available, people's job security.
We've seen a little bit of the shrinking enrollment, and some of it is, I want to say, redshirting kindergartners. Like, we don't know what the school year is going to be, so the kindergartner is going to stay back next year, until next year. But then there's also a whole lot of people who just can't afford to live in Seattle anymore.
Yeah, so I'm going to just look at this website here. And the school year enrollment for 21-22 was budgeted for 52,165 students. However, in terms of who showed up, there were 50,250. So that's almost 2,000 students fewer than they had budgeted for.
That's about 4%.
And what the result is that the school received $28 million, the Seattle Public School System received $28 million less in revenue than expected. And that's because their budget is dependent on how many kids show up.
Yeah. Looking at numbers, we are entering a contracting phase in the population.
Yes, you wrote an article about that.
We're at about 5% less across the board. Instead of having 20 million 4-year-olds, 0 to 4-year-olds, we're at about 19 some. And that doesn't sound like a lot, but it's 5%.
Well, I'm looking here that the school district says that they anticipate the lower enrollment will continue through the next school year, and that they're expecting another decrease of nearly 1,900 students on top of the previous decrease. So they're not seeing the numbers stabilize anytime soon.
I think the biggest problem here is the laser focus on translating a number of kids into a budget line, when it's not a one-to-one ratio, because we're still paying for buildings, we're still paying for books, we're still paying for curriculum development. There is educational overhead in order to do this, where each kid is not a price tag. And maybe we have to come at it the other way and say, our funding for schools right now is staying at this level.
That would be a really interesting change to make, but I think it would require changing some of the policy on the state level and shifting away from an enrollment-driven funding scenario to one in which there's more recognition of those built-in costs that you're going to have no matter how many students you have. And looking at the information from the central district office, they are estimating that there'll be a $2 million budget reduction for the next school year.
When we start talking about 1,200, 1,500 kids over the course of being lost, that's a high school. We end up, and as this crater moves through the system, you start with the first levels of attrition, the teachers who were going to retire, the teachers who were going to move away, but the cuts are going to come. And who's that really, is that benefiting anybody? Are we in saving that money, are we actually making any sort of good choices about what we're doing with it? I got to give credit to our PTA, because they went through the books and they said, look, normally we spend this much money per classroom, but we're going to have 2 less classrooms next year. So instead of putting that money from those 2 classrooms back into the general fund, they said, that's enough money for us to pay for every kid's school supplies. It's that kind of thinking that we're not going to slide the money around to cover other things. We're going to understand what we're trying to do here, which is educate kids, and use the money towards that.
So I want to talk to you now about the school year, because we're coming to the end of it. And there are a lot of different thoughts and opinions about whether the traditional American school year, which includes a long summer break, is really serving students and families well. And I'm just looking here at an article from PBS that says that about 4% of the U.S. actually uses what's called the balanced calendar, which is a year-round school calendar, often as a response to overcrowded schools, not because it's meant to be forward-thinking policy. But I'd love to know, you know, from where you're sitting right now with two kids that mm-hmm. are going to be going into this long summer break, what are your feelings about it? Do you think it'll be beneficial, detrimental?
There's the nostalgia of, the days are just packed kind of summer with your stuffed lion in a wagon. The honest part is that a long summer is an incredible expense on families in all ways, shapes, and forms. Seattle has a weird schedule to begin with because we have a week-long midwinter break. Well, we have the week-long Christmas holiday break, 2 weeks, at the end of December. We have a week-long break at President's Day in February, and then another week-long spring break. It would not be terrible if those other breaks expanded in a way that allowed for summer to shorten a little bit. Frankly, I still want July because I want to do stuff and have to visit some folks and take care of things like that. But the school schedule as a relic of we need kids out in the field planting things, I don't know how much longer we're going to find that tolerable.
Well, so I guess what I find interesting is that we have this traditional academic year that has a lot of nostalgia built in it for many people that presents a major challenge to parents. But it kind of opens up this question with our public schools, are we looking for academic preparation or childcare or something in between?
That is what's SPS's budget? Because that's the size of the question that you just asked.
Okay.
We don't treat our teachers as well as we treat our childcare professionals. And then we are asking them to make competent human beings ready to work in an advanced Western democracy. And do those two things actually connect? No, they really don't.
Well, and you know, something that I think about a lot is the fact that other countries use other models. I don't know that they're perfect. I took a course a long time ago in studying international education policy and comparing models from different countries. And it was interesting because Finland, which is seen as having some of the best education in the world, actually spends less time with the kids in class. However, the kids actually start kindergarten a year later. School days are shorter. There's very little homework. Time that's spent in class is truly time for academics. At the same time, Finland has a really strong social safety network that's provided for by the state. And there are a lot of ways in which families are supported. Schools are also a nexus for social supports that are provided to children and families. So any kind of difficulty that a family runs into, they know that they can find help with getting resources at the school, which I think is an amazing thing to have available.
We're coming up on the end of this school year. What we're finding is the gap between what we expect schools to do and what they actually can do. Free lunches for every kid is ending. But during the pandemic, that was a lifeline for tons of people. And schools also did extra collections in order to send people gift cards who really needed it. The school as a center of the neighborhood, I hate to say it, but the way we position our schools, the physical way we position our schools in Seattle, make them so kind of back room, because we don't put them on main streets. We don't make them the center of the neighborhood. They are off by the wayside, usually among a whole bunch of single family detached houses, instead of right next to a grocery store and a coffee shop and all this other stuff. We are overwhelmingly failing at integrating schools into our daily lives. And I think that it's going to just show up as an easy excuse to cut a whole lot of schools with dwindling populations and families moving out of the city.
So then, of course, there's this question of the downtown school, which we've talked about before, the fact that Seattle doesn't have one. And then I love how you brought up this idea that these schools are typically not in denser areas. I read an article a while back that put forth the proposition that one of the things that Seattle could do to improve its zoning and density and walkability would be to increase zoning density, denser zoning for more multifamily construction close to public schools.
I think that would be such a bonus because there's a stigma to a city school. I mean, let's be honest, when you think of, you know, public school 81 or whatever it is, that just conjures into mind like
the New York system, right? Where they're just a number.
And we completely forget that these schools are churning out incredibly competent children. It's just we drained the city of so much effort over the course of time that they're not, it wasn't the schools that were left behind, it was the whole city. And so hanging the problem in schools on the schools themselves, instead of looking at it larger and systemically, we fail at that. But when we start talking about density around schools, it's why aren't children walking to school? We complain that they're stuck in the house all the time. And then we forget that we've made these completely impenetrable highways that kids aren't allowed to walk across.
And I remember where I grew up, there was the need to add some new schools. And when they were siting the schools, they were doing it on the cheapest land available. And so this was land that was near water, you know, sewage treatment plants and on the edge of town because it's what they could afford. And I imagine that at some point in Seattle, something similar occurred.
Well, I think it's the way that we've built light rail. We ran it up the most available land. And that was along I-5. So then half of these walk circles around new light rail stations isn't actually usable. Where I grew up, they built a new high school and then population dropped. So the high school I actually went to shut.
Oh.
And that the school district was so enamored with its brand new building that they forgot to do upkeep on the older building. And it's just one of those things of we don't. For an organization that's theoretically put together to, for an organization like a school district that is theoretically put together to prepare humans for the future, they are woefully short-sighted. And tying budgets so closely to enrollment that fluctuates over the course of just a few years is itself just setting these schools up. So these school districts up for pain down the road.
Well, thank you, Ray. I feel like I learned a lot from you about how this last school year went, what it was like to be at the front lines of having kids in SPS.
It's been feeling like the front lines a lot more often just because, oh, it's the end of school and everybody has far too much sugar in their system.
So that's it for this week's podcast. And we've heard from Ray, from myself as well, and we'd like to hear from you. So send your comments, criticisms, and summer stories, school stories to podcast@theurbanist.org.
And we're always going to thank our Seattle Public School teachers for just being beacons of competence for quite a few years in a row now.
Well, that's it for this week's podcast. I'm Natalie Argarius.
And I'm Ray DeBicke. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll talk again soon.